Broadsheet Radio Network.
You beautiful people, it's time for shared history.
Just take a look, it's in a book, the history rainbow, the history rainbow.
If you're like, wait, that's different, congrats, you're correct. Cass did not learn to magically multiply her voice. We are joined today by many, many immensely talented and wonderful people. So I'm just going to get like right in and explain what the heck is happening. This right here is yet another episode of Shared History, but today's episode is a little special, Cass. Do you know why?
Because I'm in Chicago in person with all of my loves.
Yes. And this is also our 100th episode.
What? Get out.
Yeah, it's 100 episodes, so we thought we'd make it a little extra and a little special. So by the powers vested in us by the state of friendship, we are bringing you a musical episode. You see, there's this wonderful podcast called Then This Happened, Musical Stories, where guest storytellers tell their tale, usually from history, while very politely interrupted with completely improvised musical interludes. And I have had the pleasure of joining Then This Happened as a storyteller and a vocalist in the past. So when Cass and I talked about doing something special for our 100th, I knew we had to tap the mastermind of that endeavor, Matt Griffo, to help us out with, let's call it a little bit of a crossover. Listeners, I want to repeat this again. Every note and lyric you will hear during this episode is being improvised live from Griffo's studio in Chicago. Yes, that means, like Cass said, she and I are in the same damn place. And I'm definitely, I'm being real chill about it and I'm handling it well.
Everything's fine.
There was only mild screaming. So let me introduce you to our merry band of musicians and vocalists, and then we can get this show on the road. Does that sound good, Cass?
Oh my God, it sounds so amazing. I'll try to stop crying.
Great. On vocals, we have myself, Cass, Andy Sharafsky, and a familiar voice to the podcast, Alex DiVirgilio. On keys and vocals, our esteemed host and lord of post, Matt Griffo. On electric guitar, Teddy Oliver. On saxophone, Eli Wilson. And on drums, Mike Amandis. Again, everything they're doing is being fully improvised while we are recording this. It's fucking magic. Okay, I'm freaking out. I'm really excited. It's not about me. Cass, take us away.
I have brought a topic for you, Natalie. And you are not going to believe what it is.
I'm so excited.
I'm bringing you the history of house music.
No.
Yes.
Okay.
So here it is. It's the history of house music.
Lay it on me, baby.
So, I stole your shtick a bit because house music begins in Chicago, Illinois. The term house music comes from the club that it originated in called The Warehouse. The original resident DJ, his name was Frankie Knuckles. He was a black queer DJ from the Bronx. He started in the Bronx. He was disco daddy, all right? He was DJing all the clubs. And then this little thing called the disco demo happened. America started to just rag on disco.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, nah, I'm not having any of this. Disco is forever. Disco will live on. I love disco.
Spin me around, disco daddy. Spin me around, disco daddy. Spin me around, disco daddy. Throw my body to the floor. Put your records on your turntable. Move your body any way that you're able. Give me some music and give me some more. And throw all of your bodies out on the dance floor.
never die. It did. So that was kind of a buzzkill. So he's like, I'm out, New York. I'm going to Chicago. Came to Chicago, was doing his DJ thing because he was like revolutionizing just like DJing. He started incorporating like Euro disco, R&B, the definition musically of house music. They call it four on the floor. So the kick drum hits every beat and it's kind of supposed to mimic like the beat of your heart. 120 beats per minute. We're just like sweating on the dance floor, going crazy. When they pushed disco kind of underground, it was just kind of another representation of like a queer black movement being brought down. So this was a place for people to go and feel accepted and dance and be happy and just like sweat it out, man.
Thank you.
Frankie Knuckles referred to to house music as disco's revenge.
I love that.
It was, and he said, a church for people who have fallen from grace. Again, just for people to be accepted and open. DJs wanted to stress the idea of release, letting yourself go. This feeling of euphoria, of like trance-like states. House music, it spread, it evolved into different genres. Acid house, deep house, techno, hip house, ghetto house. It influenced rave culture. In 1982, the Warehouse doubled their cover fee.
Was the Warehouse just a warehouse?
Yeah, I think it was, like, because they would do that for, like, disco clubs in New York. They would do that for houses or, like, house music places in Chicago. There was a famous Chicago city noise ordinance that you could not play music at a certain decibel level. And these house DJs just like rebelled against that. They're like, you're not gonna stop us. So they had to go underground. That's why they were literally in a warehouse.
I am obsessed. Did you know one time I was at a Backstreet Boys concert that got cut off early because of the noise ordinance? Same thing. Famously, house music, the Backstreet Boys.
And the warehouse was located in like Greektown area, so on Jefferson Street. It became super commercial, like all black queer things do that are underground. Everyone wants to be a part of it. So it became famous. That's when the warehouse upped their cover charge. Once they did that, DJ Frankie Knuckles left. He started his own club called the Power Plant, and then they reopened the warehouse with a new name in 83 called the Music Box, with a new DJ called Ron Hardy. And then he pushed house even more into a futuristic Euro club sound, which is kind of more of that like techno rave vibe that we think of now.
Thank you.
Frankie Knuckles was inducted into the Chicago Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame. He's won Grammys. He's done all this stuff. In the mid-2000s, he developed type 2 diabetes. And he ended up breaking his foot snowboarding at, like, age 60, because Frankie Knuckles be doing Frankie Knuckles. Had it amputated a lot of that time for treatment, and he ended up passing away. Rest in peace, Frankie Knuckles. After his death, he's been given all of these awards, and a stretch in Chicago, a stretch of street, was named after him, where the old warehouse once stood on Jefferson Street. That stretch of street is called Frankie Knuckles Way, and it was renamed when the city declared August 25th as Frankie Knuckles Day. The Illinois state senator who helped make that happen was President Barack Obama.
Hell yeah!
His legacy lives on, and most recently, Beyoncé has become the most winningest Grammy winner of all time. She won for her house music, and she thanked the black and queer communities for the win, because without the black queer community, disco wouldn't be a thing, house wouldn't be a thing. And thank you, Frankie Knuckles, for all you do.
Put your knuckles on me.
after he died, they released a compilation of his music, and he picked the set list. So even in the afterlife, he's still DJing.
Yes. I can't wait to take you on a very different journey than that one.
All right. All right, and let's do like a, you like this kind of thing?
I do like that kind of thing.
Let's see. Alright, let's see minor.
Cass, I'm glad that you took us to the club, because I'm gonna take us to another club. Just like 6 blocks east of the warehouse, and you know, like a good 80 years in the past beforehand, I want to bring you to a lounge of luxury and lust, a sumptuous palace of sin, a den of debauchery serving hot ass and high class. Welcome to the Everlay Club, Chicago's finest brothel, and one of the most well-known in the world. This club has it all. 50 rooms, steam heat and electric fans. It's the 1900s, early 1900s. An art gallery, a music room, a Pullman dining car as a portion of the dining room, crystal chandeliers, 3 orchestras, 12 soundproofed and themed parlors, including a gold room that had gold spittoons, gold-rimmed fishbowls, and a mini gold piano. 30 girls who were well-paid, dressed in fine silk gowns, and who would read you poetry, and also, you know, sleep with you. Most of the city's leadership and brass probably in attendance on any given night. And, 2 diamond-draped sisters as owner-operators, Minna and Ada Everlay. Everlay was an adopted name. That was not their actual name. It was inspired, apparently, by their grandmother's tradition to sign her letters, Everly yours. At least that's, like, according to Minna and Ada, but, like, most of what we know about them came from what they told journalists and biographers. And as you can see, they maybe had a flair of the dramatic. So take it with a very healthy grain of salt. It might be all bullshit. Why Chicago? Well, it was a destination with a lot of wealthy men, a booming red light district, and a gap in the market for a superior house. Why brothels? Loosely quoting Minna in a biography, men are brutes, make them pay.
I love that.
Better open up your wallet.
You've got
the day they opened their dirty little doors in February 1900, the Everleigh Club was turning people away, not just because they were busy, because they were, but because they were also incredibly exclusive and expensive. If you wanted to get into the Everleigh Club, you needed either a letter of recommendation from an existing member, a special engraved card, or a formal introduction from one of the owners, Minna or Ada. And hiring requirements for them were just as stringent. They called their girls butterflies, and their job listing asked for girls who were well-read, looked good in an evening gown. They were polite. They had to be there of their own free will, progressive, be at least 18 years of age, also pretty progressive for the time, visit the doctor kept on retainer at least once a month, and they had to have no drug or alcohol usage. The butterflies were trained to, quote, be polite and forget what you are here for. Gentlemen are only gentlemen when properly introduced. And their guests were properly introduced and properly entertained as gentlemen. The food was gourmet. The wine flowed. The girls didn't drug or rob the Johns. And, like, music publishers clamored to have their new songs debuted at the club. Because, again, three orchestras and a golden piano. More than gentlemen, the club attracted royalty. Prince Henry of Prussia visited the club when he came through town, and the sisters planned a bash for him that included a recreation of the dismemberment of Zeus. Talk about a good time. Also, during his visit, apparently at some point in a dance, one of the girl's slippers came off, and one of the prince's entourage took that slipper, poured champagne into it, and drank champagne out of it, and that created, like, the trend of drinking champagne from a shoe, which isn't a thing that I love, but is a thing that exists.
I am a lucky fella. Champagne in your shoe, you're my Cinderella. I'm royalty for $1,000. Spend some time on me. I survived a coup, but I don't know if I can survive a night with you. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Hit the crown off my head, live it on the corner of my bed. Invade my disputed territories instead. I might be Prussian, but there ain't no Russian in the style of love that we are making. I may be Prussian, but there ain't no Russian in the style of love we are making.
Admittance at the Everleigh Club was a mark of status and wealth because, as I said, very expensive. You had to shell out the big bucks. Admission for admission and dinner was about $50, and that's without any female company. And if $50 was all a man spent when he was at the club, he was politely not invited back. The butterflies were encouraged to sell as much food and wine as they did sex. Minna and Ada didn't want them, you know, like, wearing themselves out or risking their own health. They made bank on the banquet. So it would be unusual, though, to get out of there without spending any less than $200 in an evening. And that is, Cass knows that I love conversions. That is over $7,000 in today's cash. If that sounds too rich for your blood, try becoming a Chicago politician. You'll probably get in for free. Surprise, surprise. Journalists also got a deal because for some reason the butterflies had a soft spot for them. It was a running and joke and well-known fact that if you needed to get a hold of a member of the press, you should just call the Everleigh Club on any given night. They're probably there. The Everleigh sisters knew what they were doing. Ada ran the business. logistics, hiring, finances, lining the pockets of cops and politicians. Hello, Chicago. And Minna was the face, interacting with guests, training the girls. They were savvy, and their butterflies were lucky compared to most others in the business at that time. The butterflies made anywhere from $100 to $400 a week. Which was insane.
Is that, are you counting for inflation?
I'm not counting for inflation. Yeah, so they made about $7,000, like give or take, seven to nine, in any given week as courtesans. And they probably only had to sleep with one man a night, if that. Because they were mostly reading poetry and quoting Balzac.
Give me that job.
Right?
Oh, man.
They knew what they were doing, and they were untouchable. Hell, it was a fun fact. It was suspected that Marshall Field's son, Marshall Field Jr., was shot in their club, possibly by one of the butterflies the night that he died. He died at home, but the gunshot, it is suspected, took place at the Everlay Club, and still no one, like the coroner was like, no, it was an accidental discharge of his hunting rifle. Leave the Everlay Club alone.
Wow.
Club might be the only brothel that enhanced rather than diminished a man's reputation and the reputation of the women who worked there. The sisters made the oldest profession in the world new again, and their ultimate legacy, and my favorite little factoid, their clients reportedly boasted with their heading to the club, "I'm going to get Everlaid tonight." Thus, the popular phrase, getting laid, was born. So, Cass, I'm glad that we could both spend a night at the club together on this, our 100th episode.
And what different clubs they were. You are right.
Mm-hmm. Both of them real sweaty, though.
Very sweaty.
Lots of sweat happening at this club. We're not going to share discoveries with you this episode because the only thing we want you to discover is the Then This Happened podcast. And we also are just... Big recommend to make friends with people immensely talented and then exploit them for their talent.
5 stars, for sure.
Yes, for sure. So if you enjoyed this 100th episode of Shared History, go check out Then This Happened, Musical Stories. And I want to thank again our amazing vocalists, Andy Sharafsky, Alex DiVirgilio, our esteemed host, Matt Griffo, on keys and also on vocals.
One, two, three, and...
Cass, you also told a lovely story and sang beautifully. I also sang. Our electric guitarist, Teddy Oliver. Our saxophonist, who could be hitting the club without a saxophone, Eli Wilson. And on drums, Mike Amandis. Go check out Then This Happened. Leave us a rating review. Anything over, anything at least 5 stars is accepted. If you want to see more bonus content, go to @sharedpod on Instagram.
Thank you.
Holy shit.
Broadsheet Radio Network.